All right. Good morning. It's good to be back at Calvary Chapel. It's been a little while, and I'm thrilled to be back. I appreciate Pastor Jack having me back. I don't know if you guys know. I mean, I get to travel around the country and see a lot of churches, a lot of pastors deal with a lot of political issues. Do you know how blessed you are to have Jack Hibbs as your pastor? I'm just curious. If we had a few thousand more like him, which we're trying to raise up around the country, our nation would not be in the mess it's in. In fact, I thought about Jack this morning. I thought about a quote by Bishop Galloway. He wrote a book about the founding fathers and the pastors in the founding era. I mean, these pastors in the founding era were facing incredible opposition, and yet they were willing to speak truth. And I want to share a quote with you about those pastors. I want you to think about your pastor. Jack Hibbs is exactly what this describes. God needed not reeds shaken by the wind, nor men clothed in soft raiment, but heroes of hardihood and lofty courage. And such were the sons of the mighty who responded to the divine call. Oops, wait, I went too far there. I wanted to give you the last line. I don't have the last line in there. Anyway, here's what I want you to think. In fact, I think of Jack this way. He's got enough backbone to make a freight train take a dirt road. You know what I'm saying? All right, but the point, I need to text him real quick and tell him I said all that stuff he asked me to say. Once I get that done, then. No, he didn't really. But I do think that way. And I'm not saying that because I'm in his pulpit. I talk about him as an example around the country of what we need to be raising up in our churches. Because if the church will do its job, the nation will once again reflect the biblical values upon which our nation was built. But the church has got to do its job before that's going to happen. So I love what he's doing with Family Research Council and helping to get other pastors around the country to do that as well. So be encouraged. There are a lot more churches just like yours that are growing in our nation. I know sometimes we look at a lot of the negative that's happening in our nation and we get a little bit depressed and think, oh, it's all, you know, I even have friends back home. Some of them say, Rick, it's all over. Grab your guns and canned food. Go hide out at the ranch. I mean, they just depress everybody. It's like there's a black cloud just follows them around. My friend Dr. Jarvis used to say it's like they drink milk out of a churn. They were weaned on a pickle. They got mental BO. I mean, I can't stand being around people like that. So don't be depressed. Be hopeful. Be like those two spies that came back from the promised land and said, it's going to be hard. Yes, there's giants. Yes, but God has given us the land. Let's go take it. That's the attitude that we need to have. So be encouraged. Now, listen. I want to encourage you today to get involved and do your part in preserving freedom. But to do that, I want us to actually have a little bit of fun this morning. I want you to join me in my time machine. We're going to go back in time, every one of us, to New York City on 9/11, and New York is under attack. Now, it's not the 9/11 you're thinking of. I want our time machine to go way back, all the way to 9/11, 1776. New York's under attack, and if you put this in the context of history, this is only a few months after our founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, pledging their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, and committing our nation to go against the greatest military power on the planet. The odds were overwhelmingly against us. So that happens in July 1776. A couple of months later, Washington is finally able to free Boston without firing a shot. He's finally getting that ragtag bunch and turning it into a genuine fighting force. But our time machine is stopped in New York. All eyes are on New York City. The British actually defeated us, or they first attacked at Staten Island, defeated us at Long Island, and they pushed Washington back to Manhattan. Now, he's dug in there, and he's trying to figure out what to do next. He doesn't want to lose all of New York. So as he's thinking about what to do next, he knows. He needs to know what the British fortifications are. He needs to know where their troop movements are. He needs to know where they might attack next. Washington needs some intelligence. He needs a spy. Now, I know what you might be thinking. When I say the word spy, you're probably like me. You immediately picture that well-dressed, smooth-talking super soldier, right? I mean, these guys that can, you know, they got all these amazing gadgets. They can accomplish any mission impossible. They can walk down the side of a mile-high building somehow. I mean, but even when they don't have the gadgets, they're still dangerous. These guys, man, they can kill you with a toothpick, a paperclip, magazine. Doesn't matter. And all the while, what's so cool about them is even when all the chaos is breaking out around them, they can still be just calm, cool, and collected. Ordering that martini, shaken, not stirred. I mean, these guys are cool. Not so in 1776. We didn't have spies like that in 1776. This was before Jason Bourne and James Bond and Mitch Rapp and all those cool guys. In fact, at the beginning of the war, we had no spies. A spy at the beginning of the war was a hired gun. It was the lowest of the low, the dregs of society, somebody that would sell you out just as quick as they would help you. Nobody trusted them. They were hung up on capture. Nobody wanted to be a spy. But later in the war, when we began to realize the importance of having that spy network and that intelligence, Lafayette said, we have to develop this. And so he started with a man that was a good friend of his named James Armistead. I call him the James Bond of the Revolutionary War. He was a double agent for Lafayette. And Armistead actually starts off by sneaking into the British camp and says, I'm a runaway slave. I want to help you defeat those Americans. The British take him in. Man, he works his way up to the upper echelons of the British camp. He's spying and getting all this great information. He's bringing it back to Lafayette and the Americans. We're using it. We start winning some battles. The British say, man, these Americans are getting pretty smart. Say, you know what we need is some intelligence. We need some spies. Now, who do we know that could go back to those? Hey, Armistead. You know, you'd be a good spy. Would you be with? No, don't send me back. No, we need you to go. No, I'm not going back. No, we really need you to do this. All right, I guess I can do that for you. So now Armistead is a double agent. British give him free passage to get back to the Americans, who he gives all the good information to, comes back to the British, gives him a disinformation campaign, back and forth. That man sets up Yorktown for us. We end up winning the war because of guys like him. We don't even know most of those guys. But I want to take you back to the early part of the war, where we're at in New York City, where we need a spy, and George Washington doesn't want one of these guys that's the dregs of society. He wants one of his officers. He needs somebody that he can trust. He needs one of these guys that he knows will get the job done and that he can trust the information they come back with. So Colonel Tom Knowlton is inside his tent with all these officers, and that's where our time machine has stopped. We're just outside the tent, and we're listening inside. Colonel Knowlton is trying to convince these guys, somebody's got to step up. We need this mission accomplished. Silence. No one's willing to volunteer. The problem was, if you were a spy and you were successful, you still had a ruined reputation. Your legacy was still ruined. And so one of the older guys finally speaks up. He says, man, I am willing to be shot in battle. I'm not willing to be hung like a dog. There's no honor in being a spy. There's honor and dying on the battlefield. Well, Knowlton finally gives up, turns to leave until the general he's failed. And just as he's about to walk out, this young man steps forward from the shadows, from the door of the tent. He had arrived at the meeting late. He was the youngest of all the officers, 21 years old. And he steps forward and he says, I will undertake the mission. Now to really put this in context, you got to realize the men in this tent are not ordinary soldiers. These are actually Colonel Tom Knowlton's Rangers. These are the very first Army Rangers. These are the special forces that Washington initially put together. Now, when I think of Rangers, when I think of special forces today, it's hard for me to put that in the context of the founding era. So I think I've figured out a way to do it. Stay with me on this. I want you to picture Chuck Norris, but with a ponytail. Everybody with me? All right. So we've got a room, or a tent full of Chuck Norrises with ponytails. And the guy at the door of the tent is none other than Nathan Hale. Captain Nathan Hale, at 21 years old. Now, he had graduated from Yale at 18. He was going to study. He was going to be a minister of the gospel. He studied for the ministry, decided to go be a teacher first in New London, Connecticut. And he's there when the war breaks out. Lexington and Concord happens April 1775. His hometown finds out about it. They call a big town meeting to say, how are we going to respond to this? Nathan Hale, at 19 at that point, shows up at the meeting. At 19, stands up at that meeting and says, we should take up arms, we should march, and not lay down those arms until we've achieved independence. Now, independence, the word had not even been spoken publicly in his hometown until that moment. This 19-year-old shakes his hometown from their slumber and says, we must go fight. Shakes the hand of every one of his students, prays with them, and marches off to war. A year and a half later, he finds himself outside this tent of Colonel Tom Knowlton. Now, at this point, his buddy William Hull walks outside with him, and Captain Hull tries to talk him out of doing this. He says, look, man, first of all, there is no way you're going to accomplish the mission. You are going to be a terrible spy. You don't know how to lie. You're no good at lying. There's no way you're going to be able to pull this off. And secondly, even if you did, your reputation's ruined. Your family's legacy is ruined. You can't do this. There's no honor in it. And according to Captain Hull, who wrote later in his memoirs, he said that Nathan Hale said to him, duty demands that I go. Our general needs me. The cause needs me. Duty demands it, and I will answer the call of duty. There is honor in that. He dresses up as a teacher once again, grabs his Yale diploma, and marches across enemy lines and says, I'm looking for work, I'm a teacher looking for work. And he's able to go around for several days and pick out where all the British troops are, the fortifications, the movements, everything that he needs to get back to General Washington. Writes it all down, sticks it in his boot. He's sneaking across enemy lines, and he's captured. Well, the evidence is right there on his person. I mean, there's no denying what he's there for. They sentence him to hang the next morning. That night, he's kind of coming to terms with what he faces. He realizes, I failed the mission, I failed the general, I failed the cause. And he asks for a Bible. They refuse him. He asks for a member of the clergy. They refuse that. They finally give him a couple of pieces of paper. He's able to write some letters back home. And as he's writing those letters, he purposes within his heart to do the one thing left that he can do. The next morning, they march him out, and the crowds gathered for the hanging, give him a chance to say his last words. And Nathan Hale, at 21 years old, begins to give an impassioned speech about the cause of liberty and the cause of freedom. Four different accounts were written about what he said that morning. A lot of things were said, but he summed it all up, and he was being heckled, by the way, as he spoke about the cause of freedom. British troops kind of threw out the crowd, and they were heckling him and mocking him and saying, "Oh, you're wasting your life. You're throwing your life away on a worthless cause." And Nathan Hale summed up Joseph Addison's Cato with those immortal words, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country." He was willing to lay down everything he had, and if he had more than one life, he would have done it. And Nathan Hale, in that one line, did more than he ever could have done by getting that intelligence across enemy lines to General Washington. Those words would be repeated over and over again. A generation would be inspired to stand and fight and to join and to do their part in giving of their life so that freedom could be birthed here in this nation. Generations later, we're still inspired by his words. So he accomplished quite a bit just in giving that speech. But I've been thinking about that. One life to give. You know, I don't care if you're 8 or 80 this morning. You and I, every one of us in this room, we each have but one life to give. My question for you this morning is, for what will you give your one life? What are you willing to give your life for? What are you willing to give of your time and your energy and your money and your effort and your dreams and your purpose? What's God called you to do to impact the world around you? And fortunately, we live in a free nation where we can choose that, where we can fulfill what God's called us to do here. Fortunately, ever since the time of Nathan Hale, all the way up through this current generation of amazing young men and women, we've had men and women willing to give their one life so that we could live in freedom. So all the way from Nathan Hale to guys like Michael Murphy and others that have given so much for us. And by the way, speaking of Murphy, if you hadn't gone out to see Lone Survivor or read the book or learned a little bit about the story, it's pretty tough, a lot of language, it's very bloody, but the story itself is absolutely amazing what these guys were willing to do for us. And it's happening all over the planet in our intelligence services and the men and women in our branches that are serving for us. But why? Why are they willing to give so much? Why are they willing to give their one life? What is it they're laying their life down for? The numbers are staggering. Think about it. We've had 43 million Americans serve, 18 million veterans alive today, 1.2 million that gave their one life, paid the ultimate price so we could worship this morning as we choose, so we could live out our faith, so we could raise our family as we choose. All the things we love about freedom, it's because they were willing to sacrifice so much. You know, the Bible says there's no greater love than that you're willing to lay down your life for your friend. They lay down their lives for their friends and their neighbors and their countrymen. And how do we honor that? I mean, what do we do to say thank you for giving so much? James Bradley's book, Flags of Our Fathers, talks about that makeshift monument at Iwo Jima. That when you go home, tell them for us and say, for your tomorrow, we gave our today. For our, what we're doing right now today, they were willing to give their one life. I think about how to teach my kids to honor that. You know, the Bible says, render honor unto whom honor is due. I don't think we could have anyone that deserves us being willing to honor them more than those that serve us on the front lines or our first responders, those always willing to step forward in a line of duty and give of themselves. So how do you honor that? I've been trying to figure that out. I teach my kids to walk up to somebody in uniform always and shake their hand and say thank you for your service. And it takes us an hour to get through the airport most times because they're stopping and thanking everybody they see in uniform. But that's one thing, but it seems so small. It seems so little to just say thank you for your service. And I was watching this movie, Saving Private Ryan. Most of y'all probably seen that. How many of y'all ever watched Saving Private Ryan? Old movie, 20 years old now. I'm aging myself here. But in this movie, there was a moment at the end that really woke me up and kind of taught me, how do you honor those who came before us and sacrificed so much. And you remember the storyline, Private Ryan's 19 years old. His brothers have all been killed in action. So he's the last surviving son. Military figures this out. They want to get him out of the theater, get him home to his family since he's the last one. And so Tom Hanks' character is Captain Miller, and their job is to go find Private Ryan and get him out. And so the movie is all about Tom Hanks' team, Captain Miller's team, trying to find Private Ryan, and his guys keep getting killed. I mean, all through the movie, one by one, these guys are getting knocked off. They're giving their one life for this kid that they don't even know, for this 19-year-old they've never even met. They're giving their life to get him home. And at the end of the movie, they're just about finally find him, and they're just about to get him out, and Captain Miller gets shot. He's about to die, and Private Ryan kneels down beside him, and Captain Miller grabs him, pulls him in real close, and he said two words I believe to every one of us. He said, "Earn this. Earn this." That scene morphed as only Hollywood can do it, from that 19-year-old Private Ryan to 50 years later, he's gone back to visit. And now he's lived his life, and he's gone back, and he's kneeling down next to that grave of Captain Miller, and he says to him, he says, "Tell me I'm a good man. Tell me I've lived a good life, a life worthy of the sacrifice you made for me. Tell me I've earned my freedom." Friends, it's time for us to recognize what it means to earn freedom in our culture, in our society, with our system that we have. We honor them by preserving and living the freedom that they were willing to die for. You know, Lincoln actually summed it up quite well at the Gettysburg Address, which is actually quoted in at the end of the movie in Saving Private Ryan. He said, "It's from these honored dead that we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that there'll be a new birth of freedom, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth." How do you honor those who sacrifice? An increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. So we have an increased devotion. We're willing to do what it takes to preserve what they gave the last full measure of devotion for. So what did they give the last full measure? What did they die for? Why are people willing to shed their blood for our nation? What is it about our system of freedom that is worth dying for? What is it about our value, our founding documents? What's in there that's so important that we would lay down our lives to protect it? We talk about the phrase American exceptionalism, that there's something different and unique about America. Some people don't like that phrase. They say that's bragging, that's Americans bragging on themselves. Now look, I'm a Texan, all right? I know a little something about bragging. I mean, I know you folks think we Texans are obnoxious. I mean, but you got to understand, when you're raised in the great state of Texas, you're probably 15 before you find out there are other states out there. Okay, that's just it's just kind of how we do it. So you have to forgive us for being. Besides, my mama said that if it's true, it ain't bragging. So you know, all the stuff we say about Texas being the best, you know, it's true, it ain't bragging. All right. So anyway, but that we're not going to argue about Texas versus California and all that kind of stuff. But I know what bragging's all about, all right? And I understand, but American exceptionalism is not bragging. American exceptionalism is not saying that you are a better person or I'm a better person than someone in another nation. American exceptionalism means that our political and economic structures have produced an exceptional result. And I'm going to go into this a little bit more tonight. I hope you're coming tonight at 6 o'clock. Brad Stein's going to be with me tonight. Comedy and Constitution Tour. We're going to have a great time. It's going to be funny. But we're also going to really have some really cool, hard-hitting stuff that I think you'll enjoy. So I'm not going to cover too much of it this morning. But let me just give you a tidbit on American exceptionalism. Maybe it's easier to understand if we replace the word exceptionalism with extraordinary. So America has been extraordinary, which means extraordinary or beyond ordinary, beyond normal, not normal. In other words, America has been able to produce something that no other nation's been able to produce. We've had far better results in terms of our wealth, our prosperity, our freedom, our benevolence, our power. I mean, all those things, ingenuity, you name it, all that stuff, more so than any other nation in history. It's just, you can't deny it. But why? What caused it? Well, to help my argument that this is not bragging, a Frenchman is the guy that actually coined the phrase in the first place. De Tocqueville comes over here in the 1830s and he said, "Man, something is different about this place. Something's unique about the American system." And he documents in his books, he says, here's what they put together. They had a formula that was unique in the history of the world. And he says, "The position of the Americans is quite exceptional. It may be believed that no people will ever be placed in a similar one." And he goes through and talks about what our founding fathers gave us, the opportunity that we had. And he was kind of projecting what we would become, and we have become that. But there was something about what they put in place, and we've lost it today. We don't teach it anymore. We don't talk about what's unique in our founding from the rest of the world. And here's the thing, folks. You don't become a powerful nation by accident. You don't become a wealthy nation by accident. It's not dumb luck. There's a formula that produces those results. And if you change the formula, the cause, the effect will be different. If you radically transform the formula of America, you are going to get a very different result. So here we are, the most successful, most powerful, most free, wealthiest nation in history. Why would we change the formula? Well, we're trying to do that in America, aren't we? We're trying to have a totally different nation than what we were designed to be. And now the whole nation is confused about whether or not, do we want to go socialism? Do we want to come back to free enterprise? Is it freedom of religion or is it freedom of worship? What is the difference between those two? We'll hit that one tonight as well. But we've forgotten what these guys did. So it's important for us, if we want our kids and grandkids to enjoy the freedom we've enjoyed, for us to get in that time machine and go back to the beginning and say, how did we get here in the first place? What is the formula that I need to be preserving and protecting and passing to my kids and grandkids, and not just blindly hoping that that freedom will survive? You know, in both cases, the Declaration and the Constitution, it was miraculous that it happened. Never should have happened. The odds were overwhelmingly against us. In fact, if our time machine was to back up just a couple of months from where we were in New York, if we were in that room at Independence Hall in Philadelphia on June 7th, 1776, we would have heard Richard Henry Lee stand up and say that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. Well, that's treason. He committed treason in the Continental Congress. John Adams seconds the motion. Guy taking the journal, so after he wrote their names, goes, oh, wait a minute. He scratches out their names because he knows King George ever gets a hold of this journal, that's the first two heads he's going to lop off. Well, they start debating it and talking about it. They put a little committee together to write the Declaration. That's the five guys in the middle of the picture, Franklin and Jefferson and Livingston and Sherman and Adams. Jefferson, of course, writes it all. They come back in. They debate his draft. They debate, and they debate, and they debate, and finally all the talking, one of them gets sick and tired of all the talking. He stands up from the back of the room over there. You probably never heard of him as a founding father. He's not real popular, but he was just tired of talking. He was ready to get it done, so Larry stands up, and he says, guys, it's time to get her done. Didn't know that, did you? Yeah, didn't think you were going to learn anything new today. Well, anyway, so it wasn't Larry. All right, I like Larry, but this guy was actually named John, and he was the 1776 version of Larry the Cable Guy. John Witherspoon gets up and he says, Dickinson had actually gotten up first and said, the people are not ripe for revolution. So Witherspoon gets up and he says, they're not only ripe, but rotting. He says, it's time to vote. So they take the vote fails. Three states say no. South Carolina says no, Delaware says no, Pennsylvania says no. So Delaware was close though. Delaware was a 1-to-1 tie. Now, the guy that voted yes was a man named Thomas McKean. McKean knew that if Caesar Rodney was there, they'd break the tie, it'd be 2-to-1, they'd be able to get independence. So he sends a dispatch rider back to Delaware, says, you got to find Rodney. Brigadier General, he had to go back home for some things. Says, you got to get him here in time for the next vote. Rodney gets the message, jumps on his horse. He's got to ride 80 miles to get back to Independence Hall in time. Now, he has to ride all night long to get there the next day in time. Now, 80 miles, I know, sounds no big deal to us today. I mean, 80 miles is, you know, if my wife's driving, that's probably 30 minutes. It's just not not going to take long. But this guy's got to go 80 miles on horseback at night, running into branches, he's got cancer of the face, it's a painful, horrible experience, but he does it. And he gets there, and by the way, he had already arranged to be able to have surgery in England. He knows if he gets there and he signs the Declaration of Independence, he's done, he's going to die. But he's willing to do it, so because he can't go to England after that. So anyway, he gets there just in time, walks in, and is able to break the tie. Delaware goes from being a 1-to-1 tie to being 2-to-1 for independence, which is why when you see the quarter from Delaware, you know how we do the quarter for each state? It's actually Rodney on the back of that quarter making that midnight ride for freedom. So, okay, fine, Rick, that's Delaware. What about Pennsylvania? Well, Pennsylvania had been 4 against independence, 3 for independence. So we lost by 1 vote the first time they did it. Well, this happens in politics a lot. When the opposition is not in the room, take the vote, man. Time to vote. And apparently, 2 of the opposition was not in the room. I don't know if they were at the bathroom or they just got up late that morning. I don't know what happened. But bottom line is Pennsylvania went from being 4-3 against. 2 of those guys were missing, so that made it 3-2. For independence, barely by 1 vote. Pennsylvania comes on board. South Carolina sees that happen, says we're not going to be the only ones against. They totally switch their vote and go for independence. I mean, it was just never should have happened. Okay, and not only that, then in the war, Washington documents about 42 times where he said it was clear that the divine hand of providence saved the day for us. The wind would come at the right time. The fog would go through. I mean, it's over and over and over again throughout the war. Then we finally win. Well, then they come back together for the Constitutional Convention. And now they got all kinds of challenges and hurdles they got to overcome. I mean, you got the fact that they're throwing out the Articles of Confederation. You got the whole big state, small state controversy. You got slavery and the Three-Fifths Compromise, which, by the way, Three-Fifths Compromise is an anti-slavery clause, not a pro-slavery clause. Read Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist. It was designed to punish the southern states until they got rid of slavery, giving them less representation in the Congress. Then you got the issue of ratification. How are we going to do that? I mean, it was a fight from the beginning. 5 weeks into the convention, they give up. 5 weeks in, people start leaving. They say, this is never going to happen. This man rises on June 28, 1787 to save the day. Now, Ben Franklin, by the way, is the least religious of the founding fathers, okay? So let's put this in perspective. Here's one of our least religious founding fathers, and he's the one that's going to stand up and save the day. He's 81 at the convention, all right? And you may say, you know, I used to think 81 was old. 81's getting younger and younger, all right? But you may think that's old. But I was with a congressman. We were doing an event, and he spoke first and was introducing me, and he had just turned 81. And so as he's introducing me, he says, well, Rick, you know, you're pretty young. You might think I'm old at 81. But he said, look, I was at Senator Strom Thurmond's 100-year birthday party. And Thurmond looks over at me at that party and says, oh, to be 80 again. You know, so 80's young today, all right? But in the founding era, you know what the average lifespan was? 35. This guy's 81, man. He's the old guy at the convention. In fact, there was one guy there that was only 26 at the Constitution Convention. So anyway, Franklin gets up as the elder statesman. He's going to save the day. So he starts off, and he just kind of assesses what is happening at that point, 5 weeks into this convention. He says, Mr. President, the small progress we've made after 4 or 5 weeks, close attendance and continual reasons with each other, is methinks a melancholy proof, our different sentiments on almost every question, is methinks a melancholy proof of the imperfection of the human understanding. Now look, I'm a country boy from Dripping Springs, Texas, all right? Let me tell you what he just said in country boy language. He said, fellas, we ain't smart enough to do this. We don't have the brain power to solve the biggest problems on the planet. We will not be able to accomplish this. Then he goes on to say, we indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom. Now listen carefully to this. I think this is America today. We feel our own want of political wisdom since we've been running about in search of it. We've gone back to ancient history for models of government, examined the different forms of those republics which now no longer exist. We've viewed modern states all around Europe but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. If only our leaders today would still look at Europe and go, nah, it won't work for us. They don't do that anymore, though, do they? In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us. That's where we are in America. We're trying to figure out what works, what doesn't work. We're groping in the dark because we've forgotten our roots. We've forgotten what actually works. So how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? Now, wait, time out. Least religious founding father has stood before the Constitutional Convention and say, hey guys, we're not going to be able to do this. How can we possibly try to accomplish this without calling upon God? How can we possibly leave God out of the equation for this? So he decides to give them a history lesson. We're only 11 years old. You think history, you know, you think we don't need history today? At 11 years old as a nation, he said we needed history. He said, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. He's saying in the beginning, when we're working against the greatest military on the planet, we knew we needed God and we called upon Him. We didn't forget. He said our prayers were heard and they were graciously answered. All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of superintending providence in our favor. Then he asked the very question we should ask today in America. Have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I've lived for a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. You know this part, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain to build it. I firmly believe this and also believe without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and his blessing on our deliberation be held in this assembly, but only once and in private, because if the ACLU discovers it, they'll sue us and we'll all be in trouble. Isn't that what he said? Then he followed it up and said, oh, don't worry, Brad Dacus from Pacific Justice Institute will defend us and we'll win. Good guy, Brad. I don't know if y'all know Brad. I'm sure you do. We're in California. You got to know Brad. Anyway, so, but no, he didn't say, oh, we're worried this might be unconstitutional. No, he said, every morning we need to be praying. We need to absolutely call upon God. What's he really saying? He's saying, we do not have enough brain power to do this on our own. We need God to inspire what we're about to do. That's exactly what happened, and they created a constitution that made the most successful nation in history. So how can people say it's a godless constitution? Well, they say, first of all, it was godless because all the men that gave it to us were godless. Really? Were they? I mean, we're always told they're atheists, agnostics, and deists. But look, here's the guys in the Constitutional Convention. 55 guys that framed the Constitution, 39 that signed. Let me give you just a few examples. That's Abraham Baldwin on the far left there. He's the founder of the University of Georgia. Baldwin was a chaplain in the Revolutionary War for 7 years. That's pretty good to get an atheist to be our chaplain. You know, no people of faith, so we got the atheist to serve as our chaplain. He's offered a professorship of divinity at Yale when he's only 21 years old because, you know, he's an atheist. So then we get Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and John Langdon. They start the American Bible Society. Well, why would you start American Bible Society? To spread the Word of God, to get people to read the Bible. Hundreds of millions of Bibles given out by the American Bible Society today. It was started by those two atheists that gave us the Constitution. William Samuel Johnson there started Columbia University. He used to speak at public school graduations. Here's what he said at one of them. He said, "You this day have received a public education, the purpose whereof has been to qualify you the better to serve your Creator and your country. Your first great duties, your sensible, are those you owe to heaven and to your Redeemer. In Him we live and move and have our being." He preached out of Acts at a public school graduation. If he did that today, our Supreme Court would say, "Oh, Mr. Johnson, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional." To which Mr. Johnson would reply, "Let's see, would you break out your Constitution, Mr. Supreme Court Justice? Would you look there on the last page right there at the signatures? You see mine, William Samuel Johnson? I gave you the document. Of course I know what the document can do or what we can do or cannot do. These are the guys that gave it to us. You look at how they live." Gouverneur Morris, most active man at the convention, spoke 173 times at the Constitutional Convention. That's more than anybody. He wrote the Constitution. He's known as the penman of the Constitution. And he said that religion and education should not be separated, that we should make sure that we're teaching morality in our schools or we'll never enjoy the freedom that they set out for us to enjoy. That fellow there is James Wilson. He's the second most active member. And every time I'm out here in Southern California, I do two and second like this, just in case nobody... Anyway, he's the second most active. He speaks 100... That was just for... Anyway, okay. He speaks 168 times at the convention. And he signed the Declaration. And he signed the Constitution. And he served on the Supreme Court. And he started our law school system in America. This guy knows a little something about the Constitution and law. And he said that our human law... What our Congress passes, what your state legislature passes, all those things, our human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine. Far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters. He's saying they've got to work together. They work together for good culture. Today, what do? We pass laws that are the exact opposite of what we know the Bible says our culture should look like. The kind of stuff we're doing, not just in California. I know y'all got some crazy stuff going on right now, and I'm so glad that your pastor and your church is standing up against this ridiculous bathroom bill and the things that are happening here. Thank God for your church. We are praying all across the nation for you guys to have a great victory in that this year. So believe me, we're behind you. But I mean, these things that are happening, not just here, but across our country, that are the antithesis of what the Founding Fathers intended for us to have. It's crazy. But if we would just read their writings, if we would go back and look at what they said at the debates, in the documents themselves, we would understand the truth of our country. All right, I'm going too long. Roger Sherman, Jacob Broom, John Dickinson, these guys are major theologians of their day. The men that gave us the Constitution were clearly men of faith. There's no doubt about it. You say, "Well, Rick, yeah, but there's nothing in the actual Constitution about God. There's no, you know, biblical references in the Constitution. I mean, you can't find even one thing that would refer back to the Bible." Really? Because these guys, the founders, traced clause after clause after clause to the Bible. They said even some of the things that made us unique, separation of powers. Sure, Montesquieu's writing about that in the spirit of the laws, but our founders said, yeah, we get that, but we're going all the way back to Jeremiah 17:9, says the heart is evil, no man can know it. Therefore, we don't want one person to have all the power. We want to spread the power out and make sure that no one person, because of the evil in their heart, can have too much power that would corrupt and cause our nation to be corrupt. I mean, you'd never want one person to be able to make law all by themselves. Like, maybe we need to talk to our congressmen and our senators about preventing one person from over at the White House from making law all by themselves, like's happening right now. That's why we have three branches of government, even our Republican system of government, that we choose out from among us, leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands. It's right out of Exodus. That's leaders of local, county, state, federal government. It's all biblical. That's how our system was designed. So it's why these guys that say we have a godless constitution, they don't know what the founding fathers actually said. Nobody talks about what the founders actually said and did. If we do that, we get a totally different picture. They framed for us in the Declaration of Independence. I call it the freedom's frame, that your picture of your freedom is protected by this frame, and if we lose the frame, all that freedom's gone. They put within the Declaration of Independence a clear philosophy of how our system ought to work. Tonight, we'll talk a little bit more about it. Let me just give you very quick four things out of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their... That's right, not commissioner, not state representative, not Supreme Court justice. We're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now look, right there, you have four principles that every one of us in this room have a responsibility to defend and protect. And you'll notice in these four principles, when these principles are gone, our system of freedom will be gone. Truths, right and wrong, moral absolutes, Look at all the major problems we have in our culture today. I mean, even the bathroom bill I mentioned earlier. It's the absence of truth that allows for us to get so confused that we can't even tell the difference between a man and a woman anymore. It's the absence of absolute truth that allows us to go down those crazy paths. We come back to truths, which the founder said were self-evident, which is obviously pointing to Romans 1 for us. They said clearly there's a right and wrong. We have to preserve that if we want our nation to be free. We don't want to be like the French. The French Revolution was all about everybody decide what they want for right and wrong. Everybody choose in their own mind what is right and wrong, what happened. It led to the guillotine. It led to total chaos. It was liberty without God, while the American system was liberty under God. Those are two very different systems. Our nation is trying to move down the French Revolution path of liberty without God. Liberty means do anything and everything you want. That is not how our nation was founded, and it is not freedom that will last. God has to be in that equation. The consent of the governed means that you're in charge. Our public servants can only do what you want them to if you're engaged. But you have to be willing to stand up and say, I give my consent or I refuse my consent. The system works, but we have to work it. When only 40% of the church is voting, folks, we're not working the system. We're allowing other people that don't share our values to choose our leaders and therefore choose our policy and choose what our nation is going to look like. We have to have that voice. So you gotta let your voice be heard. So get out there and let your voice be heard and your values count. And then, of course, pursuit of happiness, our free enterprise system. I'm going to skip over this because we don't have time, but you can get some of the materials if you want to dive a little bit further into that. The biggest challenge we have is the removal of truths and the removal of God from our equation. We're pushing God out of the public square. We're redefining freedom of religion to become freedom of worship. Do you know why they're changing the language like that? Because that way they can say, you have the freedom to worship inside your four walls like you want, but don't you dare take those principles and those values outside those four walls. You're not allowed to reflect and live out what the Bible says for you to do in your workplace or in the public square. That's the difference. Watch the terminology and watch the lawsuits and the things that are happening. Of course, now you can't pray at school. You can't have a Bible at school. You can't have a prayer at a football game. Supposedly the pledge is unconstitutional if it's got under God in it. We're arresting pastors for simply reading the Bible in the public square. We had a pastor in Phoenix spend 60 days in jail simply for having a Bible study in his home that the city decided was too large, even though he's on 5 acres out in the country. And they said, if you had a Super Bowl party that big, no problem. Reading the Bible and praying, we're going to put you in jail. 60 days in jail. Every one of us should have been in Phoenix standing up and saying, this is wrong, and we're going to fight against it. Ten Commandments, you can't even have that in the school anymore. Here's what the Supreme Court said in Stone v. Graham. They said, you know, if you put the Ten Commandments on the wall in a school, they said the kids might see them. And if they see them, they might read them. And if they read them, they might study them. And if they study them, they might obey them. And that would violate the Establishment Clause. That's what they said. Now let's think about this. Just rational for a minute. Don't kill. Don't steal. Kind of sounds like a pretty good system to be teaching. What do you think? But what we do? We changed two major things in education. We said no more is there a right and wrong. It's moral relativism now, not moral absolutes. You do what feels good to you, I'll do what feels good to me. And the only thing that's wrong is for me to tell you that something is wrong. So everybody do whatever feels good. And oh, by the way, second thing we changed, that kid sitting next to you in class, just an accident. They're just a pile of atoms. They're just randomly gathered protoplasm. You do whatever feels good. They're not a child of God. They're not a created being. Now think about the difference. If they're a child of God, if they're a created being, if I rape them, I'm raping a child of God, a created being. If I murder them, I'm murdering a child of God, a created being. But if they're not, if they're just a pile of atoms, they're just an accident, then it's totally up to me. I can do anything I want. I can do whatever feels good to me, whatever seems right to me that day. That's how you end up. That's why we shouldn't be shocked anymore that a student can walk into a classroom, take out a gun, and murder a classmate. Why? Because there's no respect for life, and it's my choice. And that person is just an accident. That's how you get Paducah, Pearl, Jonesboro, Littleton. The list goes on and on and on. Sandy Hook. I mean, it's all part of the same response. Remember how I said there's a cause for every effect, a formula producing a result? We put a formula in place that produced this kind of result. That's how it happens. And now, our response to what's happened is so illogical. I mean, we now punish a kid for chewing their Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun. We suspend children for pointing with their hand like a gun. Friends, the gun is not the problem. Guns were easier to get 50 years ago and you didn't have these school shootings. Right? The gun is not the problem, but we seem to think that. But guns don't kill people. No. Chuck Norris kills people. That's the other... You were close. But Chuck's a great guy, though. He's a Texan. Of course he's a great guy. But he's... He supported me in my run for Texas Supreme Court. The only problem with that is when Chuck has your phone number and he calls, this is what it looks like. See, it doesn't say answer, deny. It just says answer, answer. There's no denying Chuck. My son sent me one of Chuck, this picture. It had two pictures of Chuck, and it said, when a zombie bites Chuck, the zombie becomes Chuck. Which I thought was pretty good. That was a new one. I hadn't heard that one. So anyway, but no. You had it exactly right. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And here's the thing. See, this is just, and your worldview. Okay, how you see the world and what you believe about sin and depravity and God, what you believe about those things will determine your response to even an issue like guns. Because if you think that if you understand depravity of man and you understand the sinful nature of man, then you know that the gun is not the problem, the heart of man is the problem. But if you think, oh, everybody's good and we don't have to worry about that and there's no God and there's no, you know, heaven or hell or any of that, then you start thinking, well, it must be that inanimate object. It must be the gun that is causing this person to commit a crime. But yet when you look at think about even when Sandy Hook happened. Horrible, horrible thing happened right here in the United States, and a gun was used to perpetrate that crime. But on the same day in China, a man went into a school with a knife and killed or hurt 20-something kids. About the same as what happened. It's like, now think about that. And over the last year, it's been almost 300 kids in China with knives and swords. Friends, you take away the guns, we'll use a knife. You take away the knife, we'll use a rock like Cain did. It's the heart of man. And if we understand this, then we'll respond appropriately and we'll say, there is evil in the world. I'm not going to get rid of the evil. How do I respond and minimize the evil? And then your policy reflects that. Jefferson got this, and this is why it's important to leave God in the equation. He said, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we remove their only firm basis? Now listen, Thomas Jefferson's about to tell you the firm basis of liberty. It's a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God. Not that you're just born with them innate, or we can circle up together and create these rights. No, he's saying they're the gift of God, that they're not to be violated, but with his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. What's he saying? He's saying that if God is the source of your freedom and you know that, then you'll live your freedom out respecting his authority. How different will your society be if you're living your freedom out respecting God's authority versus if you're living your freedom out saying there is no authority, I get to do whatever I want. It creates two totally different cultures and societies. The reason America has been so free and so powerful and so prosperous and so successful is because we understood the firm basis of liberty. Now, if we're going to restore that, if you want to pass this intact to your kids and to your grandkids, it's the church's responsibility to do it. Just like those founding era pastors that were the ones that planted the seeds of liberty. Virtually every phrase you would recognize out of the Declaration of Independence was preached in the pulpit 20 and 30 and 40 years before the Declaration of Independence. So we, the church, are the ones that got to wake it up. This guy right here is Charles Finney. He was one of the speakers in the Second Great Awakening. I know it's confusing, but that is not John Travolta there. It's not... it's not Justin Bieber. It's not... Anyway. We now see where they got their moves, though. It's Charles Finney and the Second Great Awakening. They got down back then, let me tell you. But here's what Finney said. He said, the church, that's us, must take right ground in regard to politics. Think about that. The church must take a position, take right ground in politics. Politics are part of a religion in a country such as this, and Christians must do their duty to their country as a part of their duty to God. In other words, it's no different than every other area of our life, right? I mean, do you separate what Pastor Jack's teaching on Sunday morning from your business when you go running on Monday morning? No. Everything he's teaching, you're saying, okay, how do I apply that to my business? Do you separate it from your family? No. Do you separate it from education? No. Everything that the Bible speaks about applies to all of our life. And all he's saying is politics is just another part of our life. It's just another part that our biblical worldview influences. So if we do our duty to our country as a part of our duty to God, what's going to happen? He said, God will bless or curse this nation according to the course Christians take in politics. The reason is because we have a system of freedom that allows us to influence what kind of nation we live in. We don't have to just sit back and watch our freedoms go away. We have every right to stand up and defend and protect them. America is a city on a hill, but friends, without the salt, without us in the church being the flavor, being the ones that are influencing that to be a city on a hill, then it all goes away. And the beautiful thing is, we know when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. In America, who chooses whether we're going to be ruled by the righteous or the wicked? We do. It's our choice. We have the freedom to do that if we'll simply engage in the process. It's time for the church to wake up and do something, to get active in what's happening in the culture. And I'm asking you to be willing to do that yourself. You may think I'm exaggerating when I say this, but friends, the fate of the free world depends on you. And you may say, ah, Rick, I don't have anything. Look, how many of you would agree the fate of the free world depends on America? Is America still the don't you believe we... Look, how many of you would agree that the fate of America depends upon a return to our constitutional principles and foundation? Would you agree with that? What are the first three words of the Constitution? We the people. So how many of you would agree that the constitutional principles being returned in America depends upon we the people? Right? So if the fate of the free world depends on America, if America depends on our constitutional principles being restored, if those principles being restored depends upon we the people, then friends, the fate of the free world depends on you. It's up to us. We have to engage in this process. I'm going to ask you to do the same thing that those 56 men in that room did. Now, they gave their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. I'm going to ask you to give just a little bit. They gave it all. I want you to give just a little bit. And if you don't believe, think about what these guys faced when they gathered in that room. When they gathered to sign, Benjamin Rush said, they all came in the room and it was totally silent. No one said a word. And as they came in, Secretary Thompson had the declaration laid out at the front with the silver inkwell and the two feathered pens. They all sat down, total silence. Thompson looks over to his right to the delegation from New Hampshire and he says, Josiah Bartlett of New Hampshire. Bartlett gets up, comes forward, takes the pen, dips it in the ink, and in total silence signs the Declaration of Independence. Goes back and he sits down. One by one they come. John Hart, New Jersey. Hart gets up, comes forward, takes the pen, dips it in the ink. You can hear the pen scratching along the surface of the Declaration. No one says anything. Until a man named Elbridge Gerry is called forward. Now, Gerry's not a well-known founding father. He went on to be vice president. Most of us don't know anything. But all you need to know about Gerry for this morning's story is that he was a little guy. He was the smallest of the founding fathers. Little bitty guy. He was not the towering, seven-foot, Thor-like figure standing before you speaking this morning. What are you laughing at? All right, so look, he was even smaller than me. I'm a little guy. He was even smaller than me. So he gets up and he comes forward. No one said anything. I mean, you could cut. It was a tense environment. And from the back of the room, there was a big guy named Colonel Benjamin Harrison. Now, Harrison's huge. I mean, he's the largest of the founders. This guy was so big. I mean, he could have been a middle linebacker. Big enough for USC, not big enough for Texas. But he was big enough for USC. But anyway, so Harrison from the... So much for selling any books at my table today. All right, so... So Harrison from the back of the room breaks the silence of the most important political moment in history with these words. I shall have a great advantage over you, Mr. Gerry, when we're hung for what we're now doing. By the size and great weight of my body, well, I'll be dead within a minute or two. But by the lightness of your body, you're going to dance in the air for an hour or more before you finally die. So, true story. Only words spoken during the signing of our Declaration of Independence. And here's why I tell you that, because I think it's funny. But I also tell you that because for me, that drives it home. Those guys... They knew what they were doing. They knew this was a death sentence. They knew they would have to give everything. I'm not deifying these guys or putting them on a pedestal. They were sinners just like I, like me and like you, like all of us. But what did they do? They sacrificed themselves for others. They were willing to give of their life. In fact, think about it. When they came forward and signed that thing, when they put their name beneath in support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually place to each other our lives, fortunes, sacred honor. They were giving those things. They were giving their one life for us. And they didn't just sign a petition to go home and forget about it. They followed through. They watched their wives be killed. They gave their sons. They gave themselves. Nine of them didn't survive to enjoy the freedom. They gave their fortunes. They gave everything. So how do we give just a tiny bit of our life, our time, our fortunes, our money, and our sacred honor, the willingness to speak the truth? Well, again, we got one life to give. What are we willing to give it for? I'm asking you, whatever God's called you to, whatever arena you're in right now, that you add to that just being a good citizen. Just simply living out your faith, taking the Bible and applying it to your government and what your nation looks like. Being willing to preserve freedom for future generations. Let me put it to you this way. If I asked you to come forward today, if I had the declaration laid out here and I had a silver inkwell with two feathered pens, would you be willing to dip that pen in the ink and sign beneath lives, fortunes, and sacred honor? Would you be willing to give of your one life for your freedom? What is your freedom worth anyway? Better yet, what is your child's freedom worth? Are you willing to give a little bit to make that happen? I'm going to give you a couple ways to do that. By the way, you can sign the declaration on my website if you want to do that, but you got to make the pledge. You got to pledge your life. That means your time. That means simply studying. That means finding out who's running, studying the principles that made our nation great, and then finding out who the candidates are and being able to measure those two. It means finding out what our founding fathers actually said and did, and how did they act, and what does the Constitution actually say? What's the Declaration actually say? What were the reasons that they were willing to declare their independence? That's why we did this course. Now, I know you're not going to go become a constitutional scholar. You don't have time to go do that. I'm going to ask you to approach studying the Constitution the same way that you would approach buying a big screen TV. I know that makes no sense to you right now, so hopefully I won't kill over right now, and you'll wonder what in the world I was headed with that. Here's what I want you to do. Think about when you get a new gadget, new phone, new TV, you get home, it's got a big user's manual, right? What do you do with the user's manual? Throw it away, right? None of us keep it. What are you looking for when you're opening up all that packaging? You're looking for that nice, full-color, fold-out, glossy quick start guide, right? I just want to know how to plug everything in so I can watch the game. I want to see the Longhorns beat the Trojans. I mean, that's all I'm looking. I just want to get the TV working so I can see this game. I don't care how it works. I don't care what the technology is. I just want to get it working. I want to do my part, which is plugging in the pieces to get it work. Okay, that's what we did with the Constitution Alive. We give you a quick start guide to how does the Constitution work and what's my job. Not just how do I complain about the people in Washington, but what's my job as a citizen to preserve freedom? We went to the very room where the Constitution was framed, where the Declaration was signed, Independence Hall, and we put together this quick start guide for you so that you can be a good citizen. So invest the time. It's about an 8-hour course. It's all I'm asking you to invest. Invest the time to know what it means to be a good citizen and be a part of preserving it. Study that Christian voter guide every year before you go into the voting booth. Get involved in these committees of correspondence, email and Twitter and Facebook of today. Listen to our radio program where we'll encourage you. And perhaps most importantly, pass the torch intact to the next generation. Make sure that you're teaching your children and grandchildren what it means to be free, what the principles of freedom are. We're going to help you do that. We've got a program called Patriot Academy, where we bring in 16 up to 25-year-olds from all over the country. We take over state capitals around the nation, and during that week, they live at the Capitol, and they're on the real House floor. They're in the real committee rooms. They're debating the issues of the day. We're teaching them a biblical worldview of government, a founding father's philosophy of the proper jurisdictions of government. We teach them the skills on how to win, speaking skills, media skills, all those things, because we want them to be like the men of Issachar, understanding the times and knowing what to do. It's not enough to pound the bully pulpit. We got to know how to win. We got to know the right strategy to be effective out there and win the day. It's called Patriot Academy. I want to show you something real quick because it'll encourage you to know that God's raising up a remnant that gets it, that's articulate, that's passionate. There is help on the way. By the way, at our graduation, we have veterans come in who ceremonially pass the torch to these kids and say, I was willing to die for your freedom. Now it's time for you to go live it. It's time for you to stand guard at the Watchtower of Freedom. So I'm going to play a quick video here. I want you to watch what these guys are about.
You know, I'm old enough to remember Nikita Khrushchev. When he came to the UN one day, he pulled his shoe off and pounded his shoe on a table in front of him. And he said this, we'll take you as a nation without firing a shot, because we'll do it from within.
The challenges facing this current generation of Americans really are unique. I mean, throughout our history, we have faced attacks from within, we faced attacks from without, but never before at the exact same time.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world.
With everything that's been happening in today's world, we as Americans feel like our freedom is going away from us, like there is no hope for the future, but there is.
America is not only known for freedom, she's known for enduring freedom. Every time that we've faced a major crisis, a major struggle, we have become stronger as a result of that struggle.
Freedom is not free, and freedom will not protect you. You and I must protect and preserve freedom and pass it on to the next generation.
The choice is ours. What will history say of the hour in which we were called to lead, in which you were called to lead? Will they say of our generation that on our watch the torch of freedom was only dimly lit, or God forbid that it was extinguished? Will they say that we fumbled in passing the torch to the next generation?
Our generation are the ones that are going to change the world, that are going to fight for freedom, that are going to work together to give something to those coming after us.
Or will they say that on your watch there was a rekindling of that sacred fire of liberty? Because your generation stood up and you reached out and you grabbed that torch of freedom, and together we held it even higher. We made it burn even brighter than ever before.
That's the battle cry today. There's a call to arms, a call to action, a call for this younger generation to do something great with their life.
We are a part of something bigger than ourselves, and that's what Patriot Academy showed me.
And that fire burns bright and allows you to communicate to others and light a fire in them as well.
I've seen in the last several years, from the south of Texas to the north of Illinois, from New York City to California, a younger generation that has passion.
We can uphold our freedom, that we can continue to be that beacon, that torch, for the rest of the world.
The light of freedom is true and hot and bright, and no forces can stop its spread.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
I hope that gives you some hope. If that doesn't fire you up, then you probably need to have somebody check your pulse. I think you're dead, because it's encouraging to me to know that there's a generation that gets this. So know that you're not alone. Know that there's some good people coming along. Be optimistic about our nation. That was one of the great things about President Reagan, that no matter how daunting the task, he was still optimistic. That's why at Patriot Academy we talk about being happy warriors out to take back a nation for freedom. That's the beauty of being a Christian. My joy is not determined by who's in the White House. My joy is not determined by what law gets passed or not passed. My joy is based on whose I am, not where I am or what's happening. So I can fight for these things I believe in and what I believe God's called us to do, but I can have joy at the same time, no matter what the results are. So you do that. Talk about your fortune. Get out of debt. Be able to give more to your church. Be able to do more with your local community. If we want to get government back into the box it's supposed to be in, the church has to be able to do more and more within the community and once again become the epicenter of the community. And that's why it's the most important place that you donate your fortune to. Invest in freedom, great groups out there. And then last, speak the truth. Just be willing to speak the truth with moral clarity. I know that's tougher here in California than anywhere else. I know you've got challenges. Believe me, those of us around the rest of the nation are praying for you. We're with you. That's why we come to and speak and do constitution classes and all that in California more than anywhere else in the country. Because we believe that if the church rises up in California, we can get California back on track. Do you believe that? Yeah. Do you believe that's possible? God can do it, I'm telling you. When I come to California, a lot of people come to the table and say, well, man, I'm moving to Texas. I say, we'd love to have you, but we need you here in California. We need to turn California around, and that can happen if we're simply willing to stand for truth and work the system. We are so blessed, folks. We are so blessed to live in this country. So many have died. So many have sacrificed so much. They passed that torch intact to us. They gave their one life for our freedom. Now, what are we going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? I pray that today you'll ponder that question. I pray you'll consider, what can I do? What is my part? What is my role? And then I hope you'll come back tonight. 6 o'clock tonight, going to have Brad Stein here with me. We are going to have a blast, I'm telling you. We're going to do some cool stuff, but it's also going to be hilarious. So I hope you'll come join us tonight at 6 o'clock. They're going to play a quick 2-minute video about what Brad's going to do tonight, so you know what you're coming back for. I hope to see you at 6. God bless you guys.